but you get the job done without smashing anything.
But I couldn't do the job, because to do it would be to slide backward. I had moved home, to my old room, to my old life. If I went back to working for Dad, to waking up every morning and pulling on steel-toed boots and trudging out to the junkyard, it would be as if the last 4 months had never happened, as if I had never left. I pushed past Dad and shut myself in my room. Mother knocked a moment later. She stepped into the room quietly and sat so lightly on the bed I barely felt her weight next to me. I thought she would say what she'd said last time. Then I'd remind her I was only 17 and she'd tell me I could stay.
"You have an opportunity to help your father," she said. "He needs you. He'll never say it, but he does. It's your choice what to do."
There was silence. Then she added,
"But if you don't help, you can't stay here. You'll have to live somewhere else."
The next morning, at 4 a.m., I drove to Stokes and worked a 10-hour shift. It was early afternoon and raining heavily when I came home and found my clothes on the front lawn. I carried them into the house. Mother was mixing oils in the kitchen, and she said nothing as I passed by with my dripping shirts and jeans. I sat on my bed while the water from my clothes soaked into the carpet. I'd taken a phone with me, and I stared at it, unsure what it could do. There was no one to call. There was nowhere to go, and no one to call. I dialed Tyler in Indiana.
"I don't want to work in the junkyard," I said when he answered. My voice was hoarse.
"What happened?" he said. He sounded worried. He thought there'd been another accident. "Is everyone okay?"
"Everyone's fine," I said. "But Dad says I can't stay here unless I work in the junkyard, and I can't do that anymore."
My voice was pitched unnaturally high, and it quivered. Tyler said,
"What do you want me to do?"
In retrospect, I'm sure he meant this literally, that he was asking how he could help. But my ears, solitary and suspicious, heard something else. "What do you expect me to do?" I began to shake. I felt lightheaded. Tyler had been my lifeline. For years, he'd lived in my mind as a last resort, a lever I could pull when my back was against the wall. But now that I had pulled it, I understood its futility. It did nothing after all.
"What happened?" Tyler said again.
"Nothing. Everything's fine."
I hung up and dialed Stokes. The assistant manager answered. "You done working today?" she said brightly. I told her I quit, said I was sorry, then put down the phone. I opened my closet, and there they were, where I'd left them 4 months before, my scrapping boots. I put them on. It felt as though I'd never taken them off. Dad was in the forklift, scooping up a stack of corrugated tin. He would need someone to place wooden blocks on the trailer so he could offload the stack. When he saw me, he lowered the tin so I could step onto it, and I rode the stack up and onto the trailer. My memories of the university faded quickly. The scratch of pencils on paper, the clack of a projector moving to the next slide, the peal of bells signaling the end of class, all were drowned out by the clatter of iron and the roar of diesel engines. After a month in the junkyard, BYU seemed like a dream, something I'd conjured. Now I was awake. My daily routine was exactly what it had been. After breakfast, I sorted scrap or pulled copper from radiators. If the boys were working on site, sometimes I'd go along to drive the loader or forklift or crane. At lunch, I'd help Mother cook and do the dishes. Then I'd return, either to the junkyard or to the forklift. The only difference was Sean. He was not what I remembered. He never said a harsh word, seemed at peace with himself. He was studying for his GED, and one night when we were driving back from a job, he told me he was going to try a semester at a community college. He wanted to study law. There was a play that summer at the Worm Creek Opera House, and Sean and I bought tickets. Charles was also there, a few rows ahead of us, and at intermission, when Sean moved away to chat up a girl, he shuffled over. For the first time, I was not utterly tongue-tied.
I thought of Shannon and how she'd talked to people at church, the friendly merriment of her, the way she laughed and smiled. Just be Shannon, I thought to myself. And for 5 minutes, I was. Charles was looking at me strangely, the way I'd seen men look at Shannon. He asked if I'd like to see a movie on Saturday. The movie he suggested was vulgar, worldly, one I would never want to see, but I was being Shannon, so I said I'd love to. I tried to be Shannon on Saturday night. The movie was terrible, worse than I'd expected, the kind of movie only a Gentile would see. But it was hard for me to see Charles as a Gentile. He was just Charles. I thought about telling him the movie was immoral, that he shouldn't be seeing such things. But, still being Shannon, I said nothing, just smiled when he asked if I'd like to get ice cream. Sean was the only one still awake when I got home. I was smiling when I came through the door. Sean joked that I had a boyfriend, and it was a real joke. He wanted me to laugh. He said Charles had good taste, that I was the most decent person he knew. Then he went to bed. In my room, I stared at myself in the mirror for a long time. The first thing I noticed was my men's jeans and how they were nothing like the jeans other girls wore. The second thing I noticed was that my shirt was too large and made me seem more square than I was. Charles called a few days later. I was standing in my room after a day of roofing. I smelled of paint thinner and was covered in dust the color of ash, but he didn't know that. We talked for 2 hours. He called the next night and the one after. He said we should get a burger on Friday. On Thursday, after I'd finished scrapping, I drove 40 miles to the nearest Walmart and bought a pair of women's jeans and 2 shirts, both blue. When I put them on, I barely recognized my own body, the way it narrowed and curved. I took them off immediately, feeling that somehow they were immodest. They weren't, not technically, but I knew why I wanted them, for my body, so it would be noticed, and that seemed immodest, even if the clothes were not. The next afternoon, when the crew had finished for the day, I ran to the house. I showered, blasting away the dirt, then I laid the new clothes on my bed and stared at them. After several minutes, I put them on and was again shocked by the sight of myself. There wasn't time to change, so I wore a jacket, even though it was a warm evening, and at some point, though I can't say when or why, I decided that I didn't need the jacket after all. For the rest of the night, I didn't have to remember to be Shannon. I talked and laughed without pretending at all. Charles and I spent every evening together that week. We haunted public parks and ice cream shops, burger joints and gas stations. I took him to Stokes because I loved it there, and because the assistant manager would always give me the unsold donuts from the bakery. We talked about music, about bands I'd never heard of, and about how he wanted to be a musician and travel the world. We never talked about us, about whether we were friends or something else. I wished he would bring it up, but he didn't. I wished he would let me know some other way, by gently taking my hand or putting an arm around me. But he didn't do that either. On Friday, we stayed out late, and when I came home, the house was dark. Mother's computer was on, the screensaver casting a green light over the living room. I sat down and mechanically checked BYU's website. Grades had been posted. I'd passed. More than passed. I'd earned A's in every subject except Western Civ. I would get a scholarship for half of my tuition. I could go back. Charles and I spent the next afternoon in the park, rocking lazily in tire swings. I told him about the scholarship. I'd meant it as a brag, but for some reason, my fears came out with it. I said I shouldn't even be in college, that I should be made to finish high school first, or to at least start it. Charles sat quietly while I talked and didn't say anything for a long time after. Then he said, "Are you angry your parents didn't put you in school?" "It was an advantage," I said, half shouting. My response was instinctive. It was like hearing a phrase from a catchy song. I couldn't stop myself from reciting the next line. Charles looked at me skeptically, as if asking me to reconcile that with what I'd said only moments before. "Well, I'm angry," he said. even if you aren't.
I said nothing. I'd never heard anyone criticize my father except Sean, and I wasn't able to respond to it. I wanted to tell Charles about the Illuminati, but the words belonged to my father, and even in my mind they sounded awkward, rehearsed. I was ashamed at my inability to take possession of them. I believed then, and part of me will always believe, that my father's words ought to be my own. Every night for a month, when I came in from the junkyard, I'd spend an hour scrubbing grime from my fingernails and dirt from my ears. I'd brush the tangles from my hair and clumsily apply makeup. I'd rub handfuls of lotion into the pads of my fingers to soften the calluses, just in case that was the night Charles touched them. When he finally did, it was early evening and we were in his Jeep, driving to his house to watch a movie. We were just coming parallel to Five Mile Creek when he reached across the gear shift and rested his hand on mine. His hand was warm, and I wanted to take it, but instead, I jerked away as if I'd been burned. The response was involuntary, and I wished immediately that I could take it back. It happened again when he tried a second time. My body convulsed, yielding to a strange, potent instinct. The instinct passed through me in the form of a word. A bold lyric, strong, declarative. The word was not new. It had been with me for a while now, hushed, motionless, as if asleep, in some remote corner of memory. By touching me, Charles had awakened it, and it throbbed with life. I shoved my hands under my knees and leaned into the window. I couldn't let him near me, not that night, and not any night for months, without shuddering as that word, my word, ripped its way into remembrance. Whore. We arrived at his house. Charles turned on the TV and settled onto the sofa. I perched lightly on one side. The lights dimmed, the opening credits rolled. Charles inched toward me, slowly at first, then more confidently, until his leg brushed mine. In my mind, I bolted. I ran 1,000 miles in a single heartbeat. In reality, I merely flinched. Charles flinched too. I'd startled him. I repositioned myself, driving my body into the sofa arm, gathering my limbs and pressing them away from him. I held that unnatural pose for perhaps 20 seconds until he understood, hearing the words I couldn't say, and moved to the floor. Chapter 20. Recitals of the Fathers. Charles was my first friend from that other world, the one my father had tried to protect me from. He was conventional in all the ways and for all the reasons my father despised conventionality. He talked about football and popular bands more than the end of days. He loved everything about high school. He went to church, but like most Mormons, if he was ill, he was as likely to call a doctor as a Mormon priest. I couldn't reconcile his world with mine, so I separated them. Every evening I watched for his red Jeep from my window, and when it appeared on the highway, I ran for the door. By the time he'd bumped up the hill, I'd be waiting on the lawn, and before he could get out, I'd be in the Jeep, arguing with him about my seatbelt. He refused to drive unless I wore one. Once, he arrived early and made it to the front door. I stammered nervously as I introduced him to Mother, who was blending bergamot and ylang-ylang, clicking her fingers to test the proportions. She said hello, but her fingers kept pulsing. When Charles looked at me as if to ask why, Mother explained that God was speaking through her fingers. "Yesterday, I tested that I'd get a migraine today if I didn't have a bath in lavender," she said. "I took the bath, and guess what? No headache."
"Doctors can't cure a migraine before it happens," Dad chimed in, "but the Lord can."
As we walked to his Jeep, Charles said, "Does your house always smell like that?" "Like what?"
"Like rotted plants."
I shrugged.
"You must have smelled it," he said. "It was strong. I've smelled it before, on you. You always smell of it. Hell, I probably do too now."
He sniffed his shirt. I was quiet. I hadn't smelled anything.
Dad said I was becoming uppity. He didn't like that I rushed home from the junkyard the moment the work was finished, or that I removed every trace of grease before going out with Charles. He knew I'd rather be bagging groceries at Stokes than driving the loader in Blackfoot, the dusty town an hour north where Dad was building a milking barn. It bothered him, knowing I wanted to be in another place, dressed like someone else. On the site in Blackfoot, he dreamed up strange tasks for me to do, as if he thought my doing them would remind me who I was. Once, when we were 30 feet in the air, scrambling on the purlins of the unfinished roof, not wearing harnesses, because we never wore them, Dad realized that he'd left his chalk line on the other side of the building.
"Fetch me that chalk line, Tara," he said.
I mapped the trip. I'd need to jump from purlin to purlin, about 15 of them, spaced 4 feet apart, to get the chalk, then the same number back. It was exactly the sort of order from Dad that was usually met with Sean saying,
"She's not doing that."
"Sean, will you run me over in the forklift?"
"You can fetch it," Sean said. "Unless your fancy school and fancy boyfriend have made you too good for it."
His features hardened in a way that was both new and familiar. I shimmied the length of a purlin, which took me to the framing beam at the barn's edge. This was more dangerous in one sense. If I fell to the right, there would be no purlins to catch me. But the framing beam was thicker, and I could walk it like a tightrope. That was how Dad and Sean became comrades, even if they only agreed on one thing, that my brush with education had made me uppity, and that what I needed was to be dragged through time, fixed, anchored to a former version of myself. Sean had a gift for language, for using it to define others. He began searching through his repertoire of nicknames. Wench was his favorite for a few weeks.
"Wench, fetch me a grinding wheel," he'd shout, or, "Raise the boom, wench."
Then he'd search my face for a reaction. He never found one. Next, he tried Wilbur. "Because I ate so much," he said.
"That's some pig," he'd shout
with a whistle when I bent over to fit a screw or check a measurement. Sean took to lingering outside after the crew had finished for the day. I suspect he wanted to be near the driveway when Charles drove up it. He seemed to be forever changing the oil in his truck. The first night he was out there, I ran out and jumped into the Jeep before he could say a word. The next night, he was quicker on the draw.
"Isn't Tara beautiful?" he shouted to Charles. "Eyes like a fish, and she's nearly as smart as one."
It was an old taunt, blunted by overuse. He must have known I wouldn't react on the sight, so he'd saved it, hoping that in front of Charles it might still have sting. The next night,
"You going to dinner? Don't get between Wilbur and her food. Won't be nothing left of you but a splat on the pavement."
Charles never responded. We entered into an unspoken agreement to begin our evenings the moment the mountain disappeared in the rearview mirror. In the universe we explored together, there were gas stations and movie theaters. There were cars dotting the highway like trinkets, full of people laughing or honking, always waving, because this was a small town and everybody knew Charles. There were dirt roads dusted white with chalk, canals the color of beef stew, and endless wheat fields glowing bronze. But there was no Buck's Peak. During the day, Buck's Peak was all there was, that and the site in Blackfoot. Sean and I spent the better part of a week making purlins to finish the barn roof. We used a machine the size of a mobile home to press them into a Z-shape, then we attached wire brushes to grinders and blasted away the rust so they could be painted. When the paint was dry, we stacked them next to the shop. But within a day or two, the wind from the peak had covered them in black dust, which turned to grime when it mixed with the oils on the iron. Sean said they had to be washed before they could be loaded, so I fetched a rag and a bucket of water. It was a hot day, and I wiped beads of sweat from my forehead. My hairband broke. I didn't have a spare. The wind swept down the mountain, blowing strands in my eyes, and I reached across my face and brushed them away. My hands were black with grease, and each stroke left a dark smudge. I shouted to Sean when the purlins were clean. He appeared from behind an I-beam and raised his welding shield. When he saw me, his face broke.